Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with a mover and shaker in the entertainment world. I am hoping to have a very special guest today, a Matt's world-renowned musician and also author, Ken Hensley. Ken is likely best well known as one of the founding fathers of the 70s prog rock band Uriah Heep. Certainly a lot of water has passed under the bridge since those days, but interestingly enough, it is those days that inspired his two latest projects, a book and a CD, both titled Blood on the Highway. Ken lives in Spain, so we're not quite sure if there is a technical hitch preventing him calling in, but I'm going to start the program anyway, and let's sample a track from Blood on the Highway. This is called We're on Our Way.
Started out in London, in the back of Benny's pub. We hit the road and ran the miles, just to play 10,000 clubs. From Liverpool to Soho, from Hamburg to Berlin, the people were there waiting for the big show to begin. And it looked like we were headed for a real crazy ride, but we had lost.
We're on our way to fame and fortune.
Unfortunately, we're still waiting for Ken. I do hope he didn't get caught up in the bull run that I believe is going on right now. Anyway, while we wait for Ken to call in, I do have another guest, Billy from Glass Onion Public Relations. Hi, Billy.
Hi, Simon. How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Yeah, so, I want to apologize to the audience there because Ken was supposed to call in for the interview, and evidently something has happened and he's been detained. We'll definitely reset it up and get it rescheduled because I know a lot of Uriah Heep fans are out there listening right now, and Ken's one of my clients. So anyway, I'm not sure. Heard from him last night. Not sure where he is. Maybe he will call in through the show. I don't know.
He's MIA, missing in action.
Missing in action, which I don't know. It's
but
too bad
but
there.
Let's talk about Ken anyway, all
okay.
right? He has two recent projects. They're both titled Blood on the Highway.
Okay.
I really like both of them. One's a CD, and the other is a book. And it was the CD that piqued my interest. I think I listened to it once, and I went, wow, this is not only great music, but the songs are so well put together. It's a,
right.
it's a very biographical piece of work.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. I mean, because it is a in music or in a production, it is the history of it is musical life, put to production, put to music, and in the later years, he became a Christian, or you'd say a born again here in the country here. And it's interesting. He's gone through ups and downs and the whole rock and roll trip, and people dying on him. Because the lead singer of Uriah Heep, David Byron, he passed away pretty early on. And a lot of changes in the band, and then being out of Uriah Heep for many years with other people, other band members running it, and this and that. So I mean, he's had a large, illustrious career. There's no question about that. And I think he did very well with his new CD as far as bringing it all together, his life and music.
Well, as I said, I listened to the CD, and I was incredibly impressed by it. You have the opening tracks. In fact, the one we just listened to, We're On Our Way, it really sums it up,
right.
we've arrived, well, we haven't arrived, but we're on this mission, things are rolling, things are going good, and then it peaks. Suddenly excess is absolutely everywhere,
right?
But what happens when the spotlight fades? What happens when you're no longer the top billed artist? And I've interviewed, I have no idea how many musicians, and many of them are people that in the 70s and 80s would not have spoken to Simon Barrett. Yeah, they were superstars.
Right.
Yet today they're
open
just,
to. Right.
Yeah, they're just regular folks.
Right.
Do you see that trend happening today?
Oh yeah.
I mean, today's musicians, the up and coming ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I think, again, with the Internet, I think it also made it a lot easier for your average person to get a note or, get a message over to their favorite musical artist. as opposed to years ago, you know, in order to get a message, whether it be just a fan message or a business message, you had to go through an attorney or go through a business agent, and even at that, you never knew if the message ever made it through, you know, and I think things are more efficient as far as being the, you know, the connection between fan and music artist, I think, is a lot closer and a lot, you know, it's a less of a wall between it, you know, and, you know, as far as the up-and-coming bands, I don't know. I mean, as far as the major famous ones like Coldplay and those guys, I have no idea how easy it is to actually talk to any of those guys or whatever. But, you know, a lot of these guys that, you know, Uriah Heep was really, really successful in America in the early 70s, you know, mid-early 70s, you know, when they had a couple number one hit records here. Had like a double live record that was very popular here, and they had a song called Stealing that was really big, and then they had the two hits that used to be on the radio a lot. One was called, the main one, which you still hear all the time, is Easy Living off the Demons and Wizards record, and then there was another one called Sweet Lorraine off the Magician's Birthday record, and that was another one on the radio a lot as well. So, I mean, they were quite popular here in the States. I don't know how popular they were in England, if they were as they were here. But, so, you know, yeah, and then Ken went on to another band that was quite popular in the 80s called Blackfoot, and they had several hits, although I don't really know them that well. But, so, yeah, he you know, was in the limelight for many, many years, you know, and I would imagine it was, for a long time, it was real hard to talk to him, you know. But I think when you go through all of it and realize what's important, and also if you have kids and things like that, then things, you know, you don't take yourself as seriously as you would, things change, you know, people change, and the older you get, and you're not so hard to contact, you know, I mean, you're just not so, you're not so high off the wall, you know, high up off the bridge compared to everybody else that, you know, compared to the way you think you are.
I grew up in England in the 70s, and there were two very influential music magazines or newspapers. One was New Musical Express, and the other was Melody Maker.
Melody Maker, right?
I don't know if they're still around.
Well, Melody Maker is not around anymore, but the NME is definitely still around.
Right.
You know, they're quite big still.
And it seems to me, you know, thinking back, and it is many years ago, Uriah Heep always got the short end of the stick. They were never a feature. They were almost like they were, you know, AAA, but not in the pro league. And I could never figure out why.
That's interesting.
Yeah, did you get that impression? Or?
Not in the States. I think, you know, they were right up there with Deep Purple and you know, the Alice Cooper group and the Edgar Winter group. And, I mean, you're talking about 1973, so you had them and, you know, Edgar and Johnny Winter and, God, who else was going at it? Grand Funk was really big.
Right, Grand Funk Railroad.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wrote a book with those guys, actually. I got a book out on them.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a book with Grand Funk. But, you know, and Jethro Tull and Yes, and so, like you said, again, as we had talked before, but they were sort of like the counterpart to Deep Purple as far as here in America, at Deep Purple and Uriah Heep. They were sort of the same type of fame and the same amount. And you saw them on Don Kirshner's rock concert and the in-concert programs. And so, again, you know, that's why it's curious that they weren't obviously as popular, or at least by the press, you know, but a lot of the bands were ragged in the press over in England, you know. So they maybe not as popular in the press in England as they were here in America. And again, you'd see them in Rolling Stone and Circus and Cream. Those are the American magazines equivalent to Melody Maker and NME here. And so I think they had, you know, platinum records, or, you know, so they were quite popular, no question about it. But yeah, I don't know. You know, there was always that phase of music critics that's all they did was tear down music artists. They went through a phase during the 70s that's all they did was just, you know, rake music artists over the coals, you know.
Well, it seems to me, and again, you know, I'm brushing the cobwebs off my memory here, that that there were some artists that it didn't matter what they did.
Right.
They still got great coverage. And
right.
There were other artists that...
Starling,
It didn't matter what they did.
Well, that's what I think, Grand Funk. No matter how good Grand Funk could be or play, and Zappa was the same way later on as well. They always got terrible reviews. But certain bands, like... Now, see, I don't know what it was like in England. I imagine T-Rex always got great reviews, no matter what, over there. Here, nobody hardly knew who they were. You know?
Oh, you've got that completely wrong.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Okay. I kind of figured they were, because I know they were so popular over there. You know, I'm a big T-Rex fan, you know, but oh yeah, I love old Mark Bolan, but the thing is that but nobody knew who they were here. I mean, they were relatively unknown here.
I think the joke in the 70s was T-Rex had two big hits. Biggest one was a tree in Hampstead.
Oh yeah. Horrible.
Yes.
Tasteless joke there, yeah. I met wife, actually, Gloria Jones. I was working at a place in Los Angeles, and she came in and did some soul project in the 90s. But I didn't. Yeah, I wanted to bring up Bolan, but I didn't, you know. But I wanted to, you know.
I actually didn't object to T-Rex, but I didn't find their music particularly innovative.
Oh, no, they were just, it was all attitude and, you know, I mean, and he had a knack for kind of writing ditties, you know. I mean, he's just sort of simple pop-along ditties, you know. But it was all attitude, it was all him, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, as far as complexities and this and that, I mean, he doesn't hold a prayer to, you know, many of the other artists coming out at the same time, not even close, you know.
Right. I'll tell you what. Let's, we're still waiting for Ken. Ken, if you're listening, call us now.
I promise we'll reschedule Ken Hensley. You know, there's no question about it. I'll get him rescheduled. We'll try and get him rescheduled by next week, okay? And I'll alert all the, because I know people are listening right now that are wanting him to come in, you know, that run the Uriah Heep fan sites and this and that. And Kevin Julie is one of them, which I want to thank for spreading some of the publicity about it, the show tonight, even though it hasn't taken place. But we will reschedule it. There's no question.
Okay. Look, let's play another track from Blood on the Highway. And this is the title track, Blood on the Highway. One I really like. Okay, I think I might have some good news. I think I might have Ken Hensley on the line.
Hello, Simon.
And how are you today?
Well, I'm fine. I just spent the last half an hour dialing this number about 50 times. I would definitely attribute it to the to Spain. It's definitely not your fault.
Spain. I understand that's your now your home. What? Why Spain? Why not Florida?
Well, I had been living in America for 19 years, and my wife had been living there for 14 years, and I really felt like it was time to move back to Europe, and so I said, well, I want to be closer to my family that all lives in England, and what we did was we moved to England for about a year, and then we just got so wet and cold that we decided to move to Spain.
It was horrible. I did something similar in the late 70s. I basically climbed on a 747 and...
I have 9 dogs here and they all decided to bark at the same time. Sorry about that.
Splendid.
So you were saying you moved in the late
70s? Yeah, late 70s. I'd had enough of the dreary, wet place and went in search of warmer climates. I really enjoyed both the CD and the book.
Great. I'm happy to hear that, Simon.
In my opinion... It was a very blunt and, in some ways, cynical look at fame. I would imagine that Blood on the Highway was a project that you had had on your mind for some time.
Well, that's actually, once the idea was established, then... Then it became a fairly fast-moving project because, as a concept and a storyline I knew something about, it wasn't hard for me to pick topics from that era, from that period of time, and then create song titles from the topics, and then from the song titles create the lyric, and then from the lyric create the songs. So actually... Once the seed was sown and once it got kicked around for a while, then it took off fairly quickly. The whole project took about 7 months to write and record, which is unusual for me because normally I only take maximum of 3 months to make a record. But this whole project took a long time because I was using guest singers and... I just had to be a little bit more focused on each individual song. So, but it was a lot of fun to do, and you know, it's 99.9% right.
I know it's been many years since you're an active participant in Uriah Heep, and I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Let's wind the clock back. It seemed to me, and you can probably tell by my accent, that although I live in Mississippi, I obviously wasn't born here, that
right.
New Musical Express, NME, and Melody Maker, the other influential rag of the time on all things music, they never gave Uriah Heep the credit they were due. It was like you were relegated to Division II.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
I was commenting on the hmm.
You're absolutely right, of course. I mean, we got really... the UK press, except when people got Chris Welch and that got hired to write liner notes or sleeve notes, in which case he was very nice about us. I mean, basically the UK press just didn't like us. They didn't like us. They didn't like the fact that we had a big benefactor in the form of Jerry Braun, who was bankrolling the whole project. They seemed to be under the impression that none of us had paid our dues and therefore didn't deserve any of the success we were having. That was unfortunate because in those days they were, and I think they knew it, were the only medium really for any band to get any kind of promotion, because there was really no rock TV in the early 70s. There certainly was no rock radio. It was only when bands like us and Led Zeppelin and so on dared to venture onto the set of Top of the Pops that things started to turn around a little bit. But I'm sure that's the reason why the UK was one of our weakest selling markets. You know, we were basically prophets without honor as far as the UK was concerned. And I'm sure this constant running battle that we had with the UK media was partly responsible for that. I mean, Uriah Heep was not, even in its heyday, was a super powerful rock and roll band that connected with people very easily because of the simple songs and the super energy and the band's great attitude. We never got any credit for that from the UK press. We got a lot of it from press in other countries around the world, which fortunately were more significant in terms of sales. But we had to take the position where we listened to the people that bought the records and bought the tickets, because their opinion is actually, in the long run, infinitely more important than somebody who writes for the Melody Maker.
I think that's a great answer. But Blood on the Highway, both the CD and the book, paints a pretty bleak picture of the music world. In fact, I think it should be required reading for any aspiring musician. You know, you're hardly alone.
It could be a textbook.
it certainly could be. I mean, you're hardly alone. Your story, I have heard several times before. Recently, Jock Bartley of Firefall, Kevin Godley of 10cc, very similar tales. You know, if you had your time over, would you do it again?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, there's a lot of things that I would do different. Simon, I mean, the number one thing I would do differently is I would definitely not get involved in drugs, because that was that only really made things more complicated. You know, I mean, the thing is that it was like a magic carpet ride. I mean, all of those dreams did come true, and I mean, we were tremendously successful, and we got to do what, you know, so many people can only dream of doing. So most of my memories of those times are good ones. I have a very short memory for bad stuff, although I can clearly remember some of the more difficult situations that we got ourselves into. But all of the pain that, you know, often gets talked about in this era is largely self-inflicted. I mean, you know, people often ask me if Jerry Braun should have done more to prevent Gary from dying, or David from becoming an alcoholic, or me getting strung out on cocaine or whatever. And I think that, you know, well, maybe he could have, but essentially we're all responsible for our own, you know, the consequences of our own choices and our own actions. That's true through all of life. But in those days, if we got in trouble, it was because we got ourselves in trouble. It really was largely mostly our fault. And even though there is a bleak picture to be painted, you can't take away the fact that, you know, we did have a great time, we did sell millions of records, and we did do a lot of things that most people can only dream of. And I, fortunately, have all those great memories to look back on and still get to share some of them with people that show up at shows that I do now. So it wasn't all horrible, but, you know, it's... It wasn't all glitz and glamour either.
It seems to me that in a large part, the music labels played a significant role, you know, giving on one hand yet taking with the other. In your book, you point out that there is no free limo. Someone has to pay. And
right.
At the end of the day, it's always the band. In fact, one musician I talked to recently told me that his band had a double platinum album, had just completed a world tour to sold out crowds, up to 50,000, you know, at an arena, and at the end of the day, they were in the red. Is that the way it was for Uriah Heep?
Well, it could have been, yeah. I mean, I'd be very interested to see what the figures were, you know, our net earnings from any tour. But we were very seriously managed financially. I mean, you know, Jerry Braun really made the band. He gave the band the opportunity, and he ran a very tight ship as far as finances were concerned. So I don't think we wasted as much money as we could have done. I think he was pretty careful about things like that, and you know, we were kept on a fairly tight rein as far as our per diems and road allowances were concerned. I don't think Jerry would have, you know, done any of what he did if it was designed to lose money. Having said that, I think that we could have, you know, saved a lot of money. I mean, we spent money we didn't need to spend, but that was a lot of it was purely out of ignorance. I mean, the limo story is one story of many, but honestly, none of us had any idea that we were paying for all of that. None of us knew that that was all coming off the top of our fees or whatever. I mean, I'll give you another example. After I left the band, I made a futile attempt at a solo career in England with a band called Shotgun, and it was really hopeless because, you know, I was very, very much strung out. I was a very lost person at that time. I didn't know what I was going to do because I had left Uriah Heep and I couldn't get my hands on enough drugs, and I was just in really bad shape. But during the course of that time, I made a record, which I'd actually like to remake if I had the opportunity, because it could be so much better. And the record company decided to release a single, and Jerry contacted me and said, well, we've got some blank time in a video shoot between Motorhead and Girls School. Would you like to do a video for the single? And I, of course, said yes. And did the video, and then didn't even think about the cost involved until my next royalty statement showed up with a big chunk of money taken out for the cost of doing the video. So, you know, I mean, it would have been nice if somebody had kind of laid it out like, this is what it's going to cost. But at the same time, it was really my responsibility to ask, and I didn't.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's quite possible. I mean, Simon, when I had my studio in St. Louis, I had a band in there that was on Sony TVT, a band called, I'm going to remember the name of it, Gravity Kills, and this was back in the 90s, and I was sitting there talking to their bass player one day, and I said to him, well, you know, I mean, how do you see the longer-term future? And he said, well, I'm going to be an architect. And I tell this story in my book, and I was flabbergasted because, you know, a musician's a musician. You don't be an architect and stuff like that. But they had just sold almost 500,000 records at their first record, mainly because of The Simpsons, funny enough. But they've made and broken quite a few careers, The Simpsons. They made White Zombie. They killed Kip Winger. But anyway, Gravity Kills, you know, sold almost 500,000, so they went into the option for their second record. But by the time they did their video and had their tour support, they were still in the hole. They sold 500,000 records, and they were still in the hole to the record company. So, yeah, I mean, it is a matter of fundamental economics, but, I mean, when you're a musician, you don't think about things like that. At least I didn't, anyway.
Right. The There's a phrase. It's immortalized by Don McLean in his classic American Pie. The day the music died. Now, everyone seems to think that's a reference to a plane crash that happened in 1959. Actually, 3 days ago, which makes it a very long time ago, in which Buddy Holly and Ricky Valens died.
Right.
To me, though, I think it was the late 70s in England. Punk was in, prog, and rock was out. Musicians hightailed it out of England like rats leaving a sinking ship. In fact, my favorite story is Al Stewart, who I've interviewed several times. He went on tour and just never came back. I mean, what are your memories of those dark days?
The dark days being specifically what, Simon? The late 70s, early 80s, or what?
Yeah, the influx of punk.
I only really remember, I was pretty self-centered and self-focused at the time because I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my entire life. And right after that, in June of 81, I decided to move to the States. And so I lost touch with the UK music scene almost entirely. I mean, I was aware of it through media and stuff like that, but I didn't experience it firsthand. I had already bailed out. But, you know, I mean, I do know that what was happening was that the music business was progressively turning into an industry. And then, as a result, the money started to become more important than the music. And so in that respect, I think Don McLean was a bit ahead of his time. As far as punk is concerned, I never had any time for it whatsoever. And then, you know, they went into grunge, which was an avowed movement to try to disassociate itself from rock starism, as it were. And they did an excellent job because I couldn't tell one from another at any point in time. So there have been a lot of musical movements, some of which have been stimulated by sheer rebellion, some of which have been stimulated by people who absolutely refuse to learn how to play an instrument properly, and some of which have been anointed and stimulated by record companies who saw a very cheap product making a very quick buck. So I think that the musicians, if they ever had any control, totally lost it when the business became an industry, and most particularly when the CD took over, because the profit margins there were so high that it brought in companies like Seagram's and Masusta and Sony and so on into the record business. And so I think it all got out of control completely at that point. I mean, music business nowadays is more about money than music anyway. And that's just the nature of the beast. I mean, you can either live with it or you have to find a way to live without it.
I have to say, I really enjoyed your book. Some of the photos brought back some really, really fond memories.
The photos are my favorite part of the book. I can't read it anymore, Simon, because I've read it a thousand times already. writing it and proofing it and then reproofing it and everything else, I absolutely can't stand to read it anymore. But the pictures, I still flip through it and look at some of the pictures because, like you, they do bring back, you know, fantastic memories, not just of my experiences, but of some of the things that happened that I don't have pictures of, you know, like jamming with Jimi Hendrix at the Speakeasy and things like that.
And just the era, you know, the early 70s was a bit of a blur to me, although I remember it clearly. I was a teenager. It seemed like almost every weekend I'd be hitchhiking. You know, something that you don't do anymore, you know, because it's too dangerous, but I'd be hitchhiking to some festival somewhere, I'd spend 2 days usually in a mud bog and having a great time. Where did you get the great photos from?
Well, I've kept a lot, but my family kept all my grandmother's scrapbooks and everything else, so we were able to dig them up from old boxes that up in my sister's loft. But, you know, the great thing, I think, yes, it was a blur, Simon. I agree with you, but it was a wonderful blur. And I think the great thing about it is that none of us really knew what we were doing. We knew we were onto something good because people were really reacting to it. But it was us and the record companies and the agents and the managers and the promoters and everybody else. None of us really had a clue what we were doing. We were just, you know, going out and breaking all the rules and setting up new ones. And a lot of it was guesswork. And, of course, because it being the 70s, when a time when technology basically didn't exist as we know it now, then, you know, there was a whole lot of creativity floating around at the same time, too. So it was a magical time, and it can never be reproduced because things exist now which didn't exist then, that forced us in those days to do things in a totally different way. I mean, we had to just be totally creative about everything. And I'm glad that I was there. I'm glad I survived it and everything else. But honestly, I don't think many of us really knew what we were doing. I think we were just all working together, all pulling together, all trying to achieve the same thing. And I'm talking about every facet of the industry. We were all trying to achieve the same thing, and we were all just pooling our knowledge, resources, and determination to try to get where we wanted to go. And, of course, it got fine-tuned and refined as we went along, and you know, vans turned into semis and clubs turned into arenas and, you know, so on and so forth. But really the purity of it all was something that had to be experienced. And like I said, I'm really glad I was there when it was going on.
Okay. Enough of ancient history. We seem to have spent the majority of our time there.
It is quite ancient when you stop and think about it, isn't it, really?
No, it's not. It's kind of depressing, isn't it, when you think about it?
No, I won't allow myself to get depressed by it. I have those great memories, and I'm really happy about it.
Well, let's talk about the here and now. As I understand it, you have a new CD ready to roll. When can we expect it, and what's it all about? And I also have to point out to our live listeners, you're about to get dumped, but this show is being recorded, and if you go to www.bloggernews.net in about an hour, there will be a link to the recording. Okay, sorry about that.
No, that's not a problem, mate. I just apologize for the fact that it took me so long to get through to you, but what's happening now is I started work about 3 weeks or so ago on a new CD, and I'm working on it now in the studio here in Spain with the same group of musicians that I used for the tracks on Blood on the Highway. I'm using different singers for this record because it's a very different kind of record. It's totally the opposite end of the musical spectrum from Blood on the Highway. It's the title of the album as it stands right now, at least the working title, is Love and Other Mysteries. And it deals with, the songs all deal with specific human condition situations, some romantic, some less so, but looked at from a completely new and different angle. And the key on this record is going to be the actual songs themselves and specifically the lyrics. So we're focusing the production less on the trappings and the ambience of the whole thing, but more on making sure that the power of the song comes from the power of the record comes from the lyrics and from the performance of the actual song itself. That may in itself not sound so radically different from what most people do, but for me it's different because these songs are really specifically in a style that I've not really explored too much in the past. I mean, I've written lots of ballads, I've written lots of love songs in the past, and some of them have done extremely well, but this record is focused in that area, and so I think it will surprise a lot of people because it isn't a straight-ahead rock and roll record, which I think Blood on the Highway genuinely was.
Yes,
but it's a phase of writing that I'm going through that will be expressed in a really specific way. So I think it will be every bit as powerful as Blood on the Highway, but in a completely different way and for completely different reasons.
The internet has very much changed the musical landscape. Is it an important aspect to you?
Not really, no. I mean, the internet is an advanced form of communication. And that's primarily what I use it for. I mean, I do, because I live in a very remote part of Spain, I in the morning I'll read my newspapers online. And of course, I'm very much, I have like heavy email traffic, both personal and business. And I find the internet to be a massively useful tool when it comes to research and things like that. But specifically where music's concerned, I don't really find the internet to be that helpful at all. I mean, iTunes is great. I found old records that I lost and didn't have on CD through internet research and so on. So in that respect, it's fine, I think. But there's so many areas where the internet has come to be a very negative thing. But modern technology for me is crucial because in the studio we use the best analog equipment that's practical from the past, coupled with the best new digital technology. So we have kind of the best of both worlds. It's not like I'm turning my back on technology or anything like that. Far from it. I know people who do. But for me, I think it is what it is, and you use it to your own to help you in whichever specific way you want it to help you. I think if you start going too deep into, you know, the social networking sites and everything else, I think what you do is you get lost in the miasma of things like MySpace and YouTube and so on, which, frankly, I don't have the time to wade through all that stuff.
I think your answer was actually quite refreshing. That was a question that I frequently ask, and usually the response is, "Oh yeah, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread." You obviously don't share that concept.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't like sliced bread anyway, so maybe that's why I feel that way about the internet and everything. No, the internet's a great thing, but, you know, I think what you have to do is you have to be careful with it because there's a lot of young artists out there, and there's so many internet radio shows, you know, that have five listeners, and I think the only bad review that Blood on the Highway got was from some metal website, which shouldn't have been reviewing it anyway, but you know, they have like 20 hits on their website or something. I don't know what it is, but you know, the problem is the internet is infinite, and it's the stratosphere, and no one can control it. Doesn't matter how hard they try. Just ask any of the major record companies.
It's an anarchy.
It can get out of control, but like any tool, I think what you have to do is you have to assess its value to you and to your design purpose, and then use it for that purpose. Because otherwise, apart from anything else, you could spend half your life in front of a computer screen, and I'd hate to do that.
I spend more than half of my life in front of the stinking computer screen.
Well, let me ask you this, Simon, if I could be the questionee asking the questionnaire something. My dog's just decided to... Okay. My vet just arrived to give our Labrador some shots because he's got a thing called leash mania. If I can ask you a question, I mean, in doing what you do, I mean, it's probably not inappropriate for you to spend that much time in front of a computer screen. For me, I mean, I spend so much time on the road, you know, doing shows with the band, doing solo shows, doing now my songwriting classes and everything else that I need to use it for a specific purpose and then move on and then get on with my normal life, as it were.
Yeah, the real life. And in fact, my wife and I both joke about how much time we spend on the computer. We're both writers. It's what we do. You know, you get up in the morning, you grab your cup of coffee, you know, probably dressed in your bathrobe, and off you go.
No, absolutely true. And I mean, if I was doing what you do, I'd be doing the same thing. I mean, you know, when it comes down to time for me to transcribe lyrics and do stuff like that, then, yeah, you know, I'll spend a lot of time in front of the computer screen. I don't have a manager, so I manage a lot of my own business affairs. I'm obliged to do that, and it's a responsibility that I accept. It's just that I can't, I don't create music on the computer. I don't know how to do that, and I wouldn't want to do that, because music to me is something that should be, you know, at least at its origin, 100% organic. It's just different strokes for different folks, to employ a tired cliche. But I think if we're all smart, we do what we do with it, and then we move on. I mean, I have a real life and I have a professional life, and the great thing for me, Simon, is that I never had that balance when I was caught up in the thick and fast pace of the magic carpet ride. I mean, I didn't have any balance whatsoever. I was on stage 24 hours a day, and as such, I became a thoroughly unbearable person. But now, when I come through the gates of my house and I'm surrounded by dogs, cats, sheep, goats, rabbits, chickens, and what have you, then I come down to earth very quickly, and that balance helps keep me healthy and to keep my head very clear, and creates an environment in which I'm inspired to write a lot more than I have at any other time in my life. So, yeah, I think the computer's a great thing, the internet's a fantastic thing, but I also like to pick up my guitar and strum some bad chords once in a while.
Great answer. Ken, this has been delightful, but alas, our time is not only up, our overtime is almost up. So,
okay, mate.
I have to bring this to a close. It has been delightful talking to you, and I do hope you don't mind if I close the show by playing one more song from your album, The Last Dance.
I don't mind that at all. Are you going to play the Last Dance, the version with Glenn on it?
The one on the CD.
From Blood on the Highway?
Yes.
Yes, oh yeah. I'm very happy with that, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, a lot of people keep asking me if that means this is my last dance, And I keep pointing out to them that it's called The Last Dance, but nowhere does it say how long it lasts.
Right. This has been great. And
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, you too, Simon. Great. And whereabouts in Mississippi are you?
I'm in a place called Picayune. It's about an hour north of New Orleans.
Okay. All right. Okay. I spent a little bit of time in Mississippi myself, so... Not a lot, but a little bit. And Biloxi was one of my favorite towns to go play in. And then I was in Meridian for a while when I was working with the PV Corporation. So I know a little bit about it.
Well, if you're ever in this area, drop by.
Stay in touch with Billy we'll make sure you get the update, Simon, because the record will be finished by the end of March, I reckon, and then I have to make sure you get a listen to it. So maybe this conversation and the discussion that we've had about it will lead you to listen to it in a slightly different way.
You bet. I really want to say thank you. This
My pleasure.
Has been wonderful. And
okay, mate.
And this is Ken Hensley from his latest CD. We're eagerly waiting the new one, Blood on the Highway. This track is The Last Dance.
A sad old gypsy on the road to Berlin. By chance I got to spend a little time with him. We shared a few life stories on that dusty old train, so I thought I'd take a minute to share them again with you. Yeah.